Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The President of the United States is the one official in the land elected by all the people. Not really. The president is elected by the Electoral College.
In North Carolina, and its 14 electoral votes go to George Bush. Looking at the map, the national map at this hour, you need 270 to win to become president.
When you vote for a presidential candidate, you're actually voting for electors who then vote for that candidate. And two of the last three presidents, George W. Bush and Donald Trump, were put into the White House by the Electoral College, whose vote did not mirror the popular vote. The controversies surrounding the Electoral College go back to the election of John Adams, our second president. Adams edged out Thomas Jefferson by three electoral votes. Almost no one likes this institution, and for more than two centuries, Americans have tried to get rid of it. Today, 55% of Americans want the Electoral College abolished, and a host of presidential candidates on the Democratic side say getting rid of it would increase voter turnout and bring us closer to the sacred concept of one man, one vote. But it's still with us. We'll be dealing with it in the 2020 election for sure, and likely for many election cycles in the years to come. Why do we have this system? What are its pros and cons? How would our elections change if it went away? We spend this hour talking about that with George Edwards. Dr. Edwards is University Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M, who has also taught American government at Oxford, the University of London, Peking University, among others, and was the founder and former director of the Center for Presidential Studies. He joins us from Texas this morning. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
The Electoral College finds its origins and its power in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. In the second paragraph, it says, "Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress." And it goes on from there with instructions that have since fallen away. Why did the founders think that this was a good way of going about things?
Well, basically, they couldn't figure out anything else to do. There never had, in history, there never had been an elected chief executive, and they didn't know what to do about it. So a few feared democracy, mob rule. A few feared that there wouldn't be knowledge across the country. And remember, there was primitive times in terms of communication and transportation. People across the country wouldn't have knowledge of distinguished people in other parts of the country. They didn't want Congress to elect the president. Some feared that if the president were elected by the public, he'd be too powerful. So there are a lot of different motivations.
Go ahead. No, please, go ahead.
So they chose some intermediaries, the electors. And from your reading, your listeners should note that you have no right to vote for president. There's no right in the Constitution to vote for president. So a state legislature could simply decide we're going to choose the electors. And for many years, that's what many states did. They chose the electors. So the founders actually thought that electors, distinguished people from across the country, went to get together and they put a few names into a pot, so to speak. And then no one would have a majority. And the House of Representatives, with each state having one vote, would choose the president. That's what they actually expected to happen.
Did it ever happen that way?
Well, it did happen that the House of Representatives chose the president in 1800 in the election contest between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, when Jefferson was elected, and in 1824. When John Quincy Adams was elected over Andrew Jackson.
And why did it happen that way in those two instances?
Because nobody had a majority.
Okay.
Nobody had a majority of the vote. And so if no one has a majority of the electoral vote, the House chooses. So I think there are two important things here. First of all, that there was no plan. I mean, they didn't have a coherent plan. The founders just didn't know what to do. So they cobbled this together at the last moment. They voted on every possible way that you can imagine during the convention. They cobbled this together, and it doesn't work at all like they thought it was going to work. So we can't say, well, the founders were just so smart, you know, that because they came up with the Electoral College. The founders were very smart, but the Electoral College was not one of their great inventions, and it doesn't work at all like they anticipated it would work.
Yeah, the people have referred to this as the genius of the founding fathers, but in this case, this is one of their weaknesses, I suppose. And it's only genius if the Electoral College chooses you to be president. In fact, President Trump used to deride the Electoral College until the Electoral College, in fact, was responsible for his ascendancy to the presidency, and he's now referred to it as a genius institution. One of the things we haven't talked about is that states with smaller populations back in the early days of the Republic wanted protection from states with larger populations, and the South had the added challenge that large portions of their populations were disqualified from voting because they were enslaved persons. Is this another incidence in which slavery has a lingering impact to this very day?
Well, to the extent, yeah, the answer is yes. Some, and it's unknown exactly how many, but some members of the Constitutional Convention were motivated by a desire to compensate for slavery and to protect slavery. And this had consequences right away. Let me explain. Slaves couldn't vote, but states get electoral votes based on a combination of their population, and then they each get two votes for the Senate. So they wanted the slaves to count towards their electoral votes, but of course the slaves couldn't actually vote. So if it was just a straight up vote, then those states would lose power because they didn't have voters or they didn't have people who would be allowed to vote. But if they got credit for the slaves, even if the slaves couldn't vote, then they would have more power. So what happened is the famous three-fifths compromise, and that counted three-fifths of the state of the slaves towards the population. So that is a lingering effect of slavery, and it made a difference in the election of 1800. Slave states received more electoral votes than they would have if we just counted the population of free persons, and therefore Thomas Jefferson was elected. If it hadn't been for that, John Adams would have been reelected.
And so the three-fifths, I don't even know what you call that, but the counting the number of enslaved people as three-fifths of the population of a state determined your congressional representation in the House of Representatives, and that is how the electors are numbered as well. But you get two electors because you have two senators, and then you get a number of electors based on the number of people you have in the House of Representatives. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yes.
Okay. And so it made, back in those days, it made Virginia the California of the Founders' Day because they had 12 out of the total 91 electoral votes at the time. That, and then the Founding Fathers' sincere doubts about the competency of people to select a national leader is where we end up here with the Electoral College.
Yes. I mean, I don't think that it's fair to say that slavery was the driving force. There are many motivations as the framers struggled to invent for the first time a way to elect the president. Now, I should say James Madison, who we generally view as the father of the Constitution and the greatest thinker about the Constitution, wanted just a free, straight, direct vote. Benjamin Franklin. So some of the founders wanted that, but others did not for the reasons that I discussed earlier.
Yeah, it makes sense. Back then, it was difficult to travel. News did not travel. There was no mass media. Newspapers, such as they were highly local. It would be almost impossible for somebody from Maine to be very well known in Alabama at the time and vice versa. Today, the reverse is true. We have mass media galore and we have social media news feeds. But could this, because of social media, could the same be true today in that a lot of people can be easily misled by what they read on social media and therefore be led down the wrong path to vote for somebody who's not in their own interests to vote for? So could the same argument be made that we shouldn't do this with the popular vote?
Well, it is possible that people will be misled. And, of course, there is a great deal of misinformation. And oddly enough, the more misinformed people are, the more confidence they seem to have in their views. But at any rate, we're not taking, you know, we can't go back. We would never go back, even though you don't have a right to vote. No state legislature is going to remove the right to vote. So people will voting, and we would not want the state legislature to simply choose electors and the electors to make the decision for us, which is largely what the founders expected to happen, or that throwing it into the House of Representatives and have the House of Representatives vote. And by the way, each state gets one vote, which, of course, is the most egregious violation of democracy in the entire federal system, because there is a huge difference in the population of states. North Carolina, of course, is number 10 in state population now. And so it's very unfair to large states. Wyoming has about 1/70th of the population of California. They'd have the same say in selecting the president if the election went into the House of Representatives. So it's very hard to justify that.
Yeah. Why did this come to be called the Electoral College?
College was just meant simply as a group of people. It doesn't have any implication for higher education or anything like that. And elector was just, of course, because they had to call them something and they were involved in electing.
I want to come back to something you said in your last response, and that is the fact that you said we have no right to vote for the president. It's not in the Constitution. And state legislators could decide, if they wanted to, that you wouldn't vote for president in whatever state that was, that they would make the choice at the legislative level. And you said no legislature, of course, would do that. Are you confident in that, given some of the things that are going on around the country with state legislatures?
Actually, your point is well taken. In the famous contested election of 2000, and you remember Florida, where there was the problem of the count, the Florida legislature, which was controlled by Republicans, apparently was prepared to take over the vote and just cast the electoral to decide how the electoral votes would be cast. And of course, they would be cast for the Republican if they didn't like the decisions of the courts regarding the recounting of the ballots. So one can't be completely confident. But in general, I think that state legislatures would not, before the election anyhow, decide that people could not vote.
And in Florida's case, the legislature didn't do that because the courts decided in favor of the Republican candidate, George W. Bush?
That's correct.
Okay. When we come back, I want to talk about how electors are chosen. Who are these people and what the actual process is that takes place when I go into the voting booth and I pull the lever for candidate A or B? What happens to that vote? How does it get translated into an electoral vote and the results of that decision becoming whoever that person is becoming the president? We'll do that in a moment. Dr. George Edwards is with us from Texas A&M, University Distinguished Professor of Political Science. He joins us this morning via Skype. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning to Dr. George Edwards, University Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M and the Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies and Distinguished Fellow at Oxford University in England. We're talking about the Electoral College, how it came to be, how it operates, why we have it, what happens if we don't have it, what the pros and cons of it are. I mentioned in the very beginning that 55% of Americans, according to a recent poll, favor scrapping the Electoral College, and we polled our Twitter followers in a very, very highly unscientific poll. 15 people responded, 67% said yes, get rid of it, 33% said no, keep it. If you asked people around the country, would that be pretty much the way it went, Doctor?
Yes. At every poll, that, as far as I know, every poll that's ever been taken, every national poll, has found that at least a majority, and often a large majority, of the public wants direct election of the president. Direct election simply means we go to the polls, we add up all the votes, whoever gets the most votes wins.
And why don't we? If people want it, why don't they get it?
Well, the fundamental reason is we might call political greed, because a party in one state or another state likes the system because, for example, in any state, it's the same principle. You get to give all your electoral votes to one candidate. So if you're the dominant party, you want to give all your electoral votes. Even if you get 51% of the vote, if your party's candidate gets 51% of the vote, or it could even be 46% of the vote if there's more than two candidates, if you get the most votes in the state, even if you don't get a majority, you get all of the electoral votes. And so the dominant party in a state likes that very much because they get all the cookies. And so that's one reason. The second reason is misunderstanding. And many people think that there's an advantage to having an electoral college. Either the small states somehow are protected, which isn't true, or it will affect the way campaigns take place in some way. And so they really haven't thought through this usually. But anyhow, those reasons and the fact that it's difficult to change the Constitution are why we still have the Electoral College.
So let's talk about who these people are, these electors, and how they come to be electors, and how that process, if it has, changed over the years. Who are these people?
Well, the people who are electors are generally unknown, although occasionally some distinguished people are made electors. But state conventions, state party conventions, nominate the electors in most states. So they have a slate of electors and they are nominated by the state party conventions. Sometimes state party central committees do it. But there's a range of ways, and that it has changed over time, but they are party representatives. So they are selected by their party, and the actual people that they may just be old, you know, party regulars, party stalwarts, and they're getting a reward or something for having, you know, served the party. That is typically who they are. And of course, essentially no one knows. It's not that it's a secret, but we pay no attention to those individuals.
So both parties do this at their state convention. So the Democrats get together and they nominate their slate of electors. The Republicans get together. They do the same thing. And let's just say, for the purposes of this discussion, that the Republican presidential candidate gets 48% of the popular vote and the Democrat gets 50% of the popular vote, and the independent candidates get 2% of the popular vote. That's 100%, I think, if I've done the math in my head right.
Right.
So why then don't 48, if there are 100 electors, why don't 48 Republicans go to vote and 50, whatever number I threw out there, 50 Democrats go to vote and two independents go to vote, and that ends up being the Electoral College vote from that state? Why is the majority popular vote candidate getting all of the votes? Was that intended by the founders?
It's because it wasn't intended by the founders. And they never, first of all, there weren't parties. When the Constitution was was created, there weren't any political parties. So they didn't think about party slates. And they just expected there'd be electors making independent decisions. At any rate, each state gets to decide how it will distribute its electoral votes. 48 of the 50 states, the two exceptions being Maine and Nebraska, have chosen to give all of their electoral votes to whoever comes in first. Now, of course, this greatly distorts the will of the people, as in the example that you just gave, because half the people didn't vote, in your example, for the Democratic candidate, but the Democratic candidate, in your example, would get all the electoral votes. So it's just like the other half of the people in that state didn't show up because their votes don't count. And they can't be aggregated across the nation. So it's political greed. The dominant party says we want it all.
And is it in the Constitution that states get to make the decision that they're going to give all the votes to the majority winner or to the highest vote getter, as opposed to Nebraska and Maine? I mean, who said they could make that decision?
The Constitution gives states the right to allocate their electoral votes how they wish. And as I say, originally they didn't do that. And James Madison famously complained about that, as once political parties developed and crafty politicians decided, hey, there's a way we can get an advantage here, and that upset some of the founders, including James Madison, but nevertheless they continue to do it.
So the process for voting and for whom to vote in the Electoral College has in fact changed from what was outlined in the Constitution, as has the mandate that the second highest vote getter for president become vice president. And that's why we've had, at least in the first two elections, we had an uneasy relationship between president and vice president because they were actually vying for the top spot. If those things have been permitted to change, why are we stuck with the Electoral College?
Well, we're still stuck with it because we can't get, it's hard to change the Constitution. And parties, the dominant party in states, don't want to give up their power. And as I said before, there is a broad view held by millions of people that the Electoral College has some advantages, that it does something for them and it protects some interests. Now, that's not true. For example, they say, well, it protects the interests of small states. Candidates have to pay attention to small states. Well, anybody can trace where every presidential candidate goes in the entire election. We don't have stealth candidacies for president. So we know every ad that they run, every speech that they make. We know everything they say when they make those speeches. And they just ignore the small states unless they happen to be competitive. So, for example, in the last election, the 2016 election, there are seven states with three electoral votes. That's plus Washington, D.C. So they're the smallest ones. They're the ones that need the most protection. No presidential candidate went to any of those states in the entire election period. None. I mean, zero. They ran and they ran no ads in those states. They're not taking their case to the people. They're not being extra attentive to the small states. So that just doesn't happen. And it's very easy to determine that. All one has to do is actually look in a somewhat rigorous fashion. But that's an example of how people have in their minds, well, it somehow makes candidates, you know, be attentive to small states, which it doesn't.
Despite the fact that two of the last three presidents were elected by the Electoral College and not by the popular vote, how many times has the Electoral College actually overruled the popular vote? It hasn't been many times, has it?
Well, it's been I would say five times. The first one was in 1824, as I said, when Andrew Jackson got the most votes. And John Quincy Adams was elected in the House of Representatives. Then it happened when Grover Cleveland lost to Benjamin Harrison in 1888. And we know about 2000 and 2016. But I would also say a good argument could be made that actually JFK received fewer votes than Richard Nixon in 1960. I'm not talking about any fraud issues or anything like that. It's just, but it raises an interesting point. Because the number of votes a candidate receives doesn't really matter, the total number of votes, no one was in charge of you know, adding it up. So we basically think that Nixon got more votes because the Associated Press added up the votes and said, well, Kennedy got 118,000 more votes, because they gave all the votes from Alabama to Kennedy, even though many of the electors in Alabama ran against Kennedy electors and won and said, we're not going to vote for Kennedy. And when it came time to cast the electoral votes, they didn't vote for Kennedy. So if we don't actually give all the votes in Alabama to Kennedy, Nixon got the most votes.
Wow. And there was no brouhaha over that. Why not?
Well, first of all, I don't think people even understood what was happening in Alabama. And as I said,
the party certainly understood it, don't you think?
I'm not sure. Nixon just decided that he didn't want to have a conflict at that point, okay. The same way that he didn't really pursue some charges of electoral fraud in a number of states, most famously Illinois. Now it turns out that in Illinois that wouldn't have changed. As best we can tell, it wouldn't have changed the outcome of the election in that state. But the fact is that there is no way to resolve this, because the Electoral College is so sloppy. There's no absolutely perfect way to resolve how many votes were actually cast for Kennedy in Alabama.
Just so people know, this institution has never been popular, not even from the very beginning. In the first 100 years, under the Constitution, because we have the Articles of Confederation first, but under the Constitution in the first 100 years of this republic, 160 amendments were introduced in Congress to reform the Electoral College. From that time, 1889 through 1946, there were 109 proposed amendments, and from 1947 to 1968, there were 265. In fact, virtually every single session of Congress has seen proposals, and yet it is still with us. Now we have the slate of candidates running on the Democratic side of the aisle for the 2020 contest, and most of them, if not all of them, favor the abolition of the Electoral College, because doing so would bring us closer to one man, one vote. Is that true? Would it?
Well, it certainly would. I mean, every vote would count exactly the same. Right now, it doesn't. Every vote would count the same, and it's perfect equality, because you add up all the votes across the country, and whoever gets the most votes wins. It's not a radical concept. Because almost every election in America follows exactly that principle.
And why is that a bad thing at the presidential level? Because it seems to me that if there are more people in California and New York and North Carolina than there are in Wyoming or North Dakota or Nebraska, why shouldn't the decision of the individual people in those states carry more weight than those in the lower population states? Would it not be a more pure example of what people are thinking and what they want at the time?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that is what democracy is all about. We have no alternative principle. We have no principled argument. We have no philosophy of democracy or philosophy of government, which says that, well, some people ought to have more say in selecting the president than others. And one can just, I live in the state of Texas. Texas is very urban. We've got 5 of the 20 biggest cities in the country here in Texas. However, we also have vast stretches of area that are very sparsely populated. So there's a lot of variation in Texas, and it's 800 miles across and it's 800 miles long. And at any rate, the point is, when we have an election, we don't say, well, those people in the sparsely populated areas, they get more say in selecting the governor than the people who live in Houston. I mean, and that would never fly. I mean, that offends one's sensibilities, a notion of what democracy is all about. Well, the same thing ought to apply, I think, to the selection of the president.
So the people who believe that ending the Electoral College would be a good thing also believe that it would lead to greater voter participation. Do you think that that's right? Do you think that the average person believes that they don't need to, or they don't want to, or they don't want to bother voting for the president because their vote doesn't count given the way the Electoral College works?
Well, people think about that. That in many states, people are discouraged from voting because it doesn't matter. They already know how the state's going to go. So why turn out? We know that if there's more competition within a state, then there's likely to be more informed voters and higher levels of voter participation, both of which are good in a democracy. And so I don't think there's any question that abolishing the Electoral College and having direct election of the president would increase voter turnout, increase voter participation in general in the election, and increase voter information.
You can forgive the Founding Fathers for this glaring error, one presumes, because they were just making this stuff up. And this had never been done before. There was no guiding principle that they could point to and say, well, they did it like this. This would be a good idea to adopt. Nobody had ever done this before. But now we have 200-plus years of this under our belt, and yet we have this problem. We have the problem of gerrymandering. We have the problem of trying to control how the census is conducted, because that's how congressional representation and apportionment and eventually the Electoral College is chosen based on who responds to the census and how they respond. It's almost as though we want to brag about being this enlightened democracy on the one hand. On the other hand, we want to do everything we can to control the outcome. And that's not democratic. Why this bifurcated attitude?
Well, again, I come back to political greed. People want people in charge, people in control. The dominant party wants to give themselves an advantage. Right now, attitudes about the Electoral College are heavily partisan based. So Republicans, not overwhelmingly, but Republicans, because they benefited from the Electoral College and two of the last five elections, tend to like the Electoral College. And everyone else, Democrats and independents, don't like the Electoral College. So it's political advantage is a big problem. And it's difficult to turn people to evaluate political institutions in terms of principle.
So when we come back, we're going to talk about what would happen if it went away. How would it change presidential campaigns? How would it change the outcome of elections? How would it change the amount of voter participation we witness every 4 years? We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. George Edwards joins us this morning via Skype. He's the University Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M and the Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies and Distinguished Fellow at Oxford University. He's also taught at the University of London and Peking University, among other locations. We have a question here from Kirby, who emails, is it just a coincidence that Democratic candidates have always been the ones shafted by the Electoral College despite winning the popular vote? Has it ever happened to a Republican or a Whig?
It has not happened to them.
Why?
I don't think that there's an inherent reason in the Electoral College that it's inherently
biased. Is it not because it favors rural areas over urban areas in some way by rebalancing the equation?
Yes, it hasn't always been the case that rural areas were okay. Republican. Right now, it does favor rural areas. It's always favored rural areas because small states get a little extra say in the Electoral College because they get the two votes for their two United States senators. That's not the biggest problem of the Electoral College. The biggest problem is what we call the unit voting, where the states have chosen to give all of their electoral votes to whoever comes in first. And that is the great distortion of the translation of individual votes into electoral votes.
And could that not be fixed by a federal law? I mean, because that wouldn't be tampering with the Constitution. That would just be directing the states on how to use their votes.
I think it would require it would require a change in the Constitution. Okay. I'm afraid there is a very clever proposal which a number of states have passed, and it's an interstate compact proposal, and so states get together and they agree that they will give their electoral votes to whoever comes in first in the nation. And it is getting close to 200, and states representing close to 200 electoral votes have now passed this. And when it gets to be half of the electoral votes, states representing half of the electoral votes, that in effect would change the Electoral College without changing the Constitution.
And what's the motivation for these states doing this?
The motivation was simply the principle of democracy and direct election. Now, it turns out that almost all of these states have been Democratic states. So one could say one motivation is that they don't like the fact that the Electoral College seems to have favored the Republicans in recent times.
In our earliest days, there were concerns, legitimate concerns, I suppose, about more urban centers dominating elections to the detriment of less populated areas. And today we continue to have this urban-rural divide where the urban areas have one way of thinking, it seems, and rural areas are more conservative and vote for a different political party. If you changed the Electoral College or eliminated the Electoral College so that the popular vote ruled more often, would that exacerbate that divide? Would people in the rural areas really feel that they're not part of all this?
I'm not sure how they would feel. First of all, we have to remember that people in rural areas are greatly overrepresented in the United States Senate, which is a very powerful body. So they are very well protected by the U.S. Constitution. Very little can happen that they don't want to happen. So that's the first thing. They are already well protected. They don't need additional protections. Second, I would add that large states, we tend to think of large states also as being urban states. Large states are very competitive frequently, and if you added up all the votes in the 10 largest states in the last election, for example, they almost divide equally. It's almost 50-50. And actually, Donald Trump, although he lost decisively in the popular vote, won 7 of the 10 largest states in the last election. So it's not true that small states necessarily are all only Republican and that large states are only Democrat. So that's the best answer I can give you.
Okay. We have an email from Jonathan who says, Wyoming gets one elector for each 195,000 residents, and North Carolina gets one elector per 725,000 residents. It gets worse. California has 55 electoral votes, Wyoming 3, but California has 705,454 people per vote, with only 194,717 per vote in Wyoming. Clearly not the intent of the framers, Jonathan emails. What incentives do elected officials of Wyoming, Vermont, Alaska, the Dakotas, Rhode Island, Delaware, Maine, etc., have to change the current system? None? Any?
Well, if you look at it from the standpoint of just getting the most for yourself, they have very little incentive. If you look at it from the standpoint of principle, they have some incentive. And I believe that Vermont is one of the states that has agreed to this interstate compact that I described a few minutes ago, just by way of example. So, but your listener is absolutely right. That is something we have to overcome because some states think that they are advantaged by this. I should also say that Maine and Nebraska have chosen to split their electoral votes, to not follow the unit vote system, and again, on the matter of principle, to try to more accurately reflect the views of the voters in those states.
So Jimmy on Twitter writes, the parties are why the Electoral College doesn't work. The founders' intent was negated when the party reps in the college started voting lockstep with their party. Get rid of one or the other. I would prefer to see the parties go away. But didn't political parties come to be in part because of the Electoral College and the process it used for choosing the president and vice president.
Well, it's hard to say exactly. There are many causes for the development of political parties. And one was there was just a split in views between the Federalists and what were then called the Democratic Republicans. So we can think of the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians, different views about government. But they certainly had an incentive because of Electoral College to organize themselves to win the big prize. So that's right. And so you put the same candidate on the ballot under the same label in every state, and that made it easier to get the prize. So these are all interrelated. So it's a good point.
Guy emails, direct election of the president would mean that voter fraud could swing the election. Fraud is harder with the Electoral College. And many people have said that the Electoral College is a firewall against that kind of election tampering. Do you agree?
No, that's absolutely wrong. It's exactly the opposite. The incentive for fraud is much greater under the Electoral College. Think about this. In Florida, the election was determined by Bush winning. Let's just say that the count was accurate. The count was stopped, so we really don't know, by 539 votes. Al Gore got 1,000 times as many votes as that across the nation. So all you had to do in Florida was steal if it was fraud. And I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying if you were going to steal an election, you wouldn't have to steal very many votes in a state. And you don't have to have as big an organization. But if you're going to do fraud across the nation and a scale that we have never seen before and essentially unimaginable, you'd have to steal an enormous number of votes. And you wouldn't know whether you need to steal them or not before the election. And it'd be much, much harder to overcome these large margins of victory. In 2016, there was a 3 million vote difference between the candidates. Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. So you'd have to steal that many votes to change that outcome. But in the close states, in those states that came down to the wire on election night, and I'm talking about Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, the total number of the difference was only 77,000 votes. So you have to steal many fewer votes in a state. It's much easier to commit fraud in a state than it is across the whole nation.
Many people don't like the political parties, particularly what's going on with them today and the way they line up with their opinions and policies and with voters. And many people, because of that, are attracted to third-party candidates who never get elected. They're always spoilers. They will never get elected. How much of that, how much of the fact that third parties will never be successful has to do with how the Electoral College works?
Well, the Electoral College isn't necessarily a problem for third parties. It actually gives them more potential because they can win a prize, they can win a state. Whereas if in direct election, they'd have to come in first. If you don't come in first, you don't get anything. In the Electoral College, if you just win a state, and occasionally that happens. It happened, for example, thinking of George Wallace in 1968. We can think of Strom Thurmond in 1948, winning some states. But the problem here is that there's a lot of potential for mischief, because if you prevent anybody from getting a majority, then it gets thrown into the House of Representatives. But there's another problem under the Electoral College with third parties, and that is third parties can distort the election. Because let's take the election of 2000, which was very close. So Ralph Nader is a candidate across the nation. Ralph Nader gets enough votes, taking enough votes from Al Gore in Florida to change the outcome, because Al Gore was the preferred candidate between Bush and Gore in Florida. Let me explain this again. If Nader wasn't on the ballot, Gore would have won. He would have won Florida. He would have become president. The same thing was true in New Hampshire. So the fact that Ralph Nader was on the ballot cost Al Gore the presidency. because Gore was the preferred candidate across Floridians and across folks in New Hampshire. So this is a problem of third parties under the Electoral College.
So we're also a federal republic. Some have argued that dismantling the Electoral College would mean dismantling federalism, because there would be no sense in having a Senate there, which represents the interest of states, and eventually there'd be no interest in having states. States would just become like local governments to administer the dictates of the federal government. Do you agree with that?
No, that I think that's completely wrong.
Okay.
If you got rid of the Electoral College and just had direct election, it wouldn't affect the power of states at all. The power of states comes directly from the Constitution and from its representation in Congress. So it wouldn't affect anything about what states do, any powers that they have, any representation they have in Congress, nothing at all. Moreover, I should say that the framers never thought of the Electoral College as an aspect of federalism. In the entire discussion of the Electoral College in the Constitutional Convention, federalism never came up once, not one time. Not one single word was said about it. So it really isn't essential for federalism in any way.
So what do you maybe you don't see both sides, but what do you see as the pros and cons of the system we have?
Well, the big con of the system we have is that it doesn't represent the will of the people, which most people would think is what democracy is all about. And it violates political equality, which is essential in every single philosophic treatise on democracy. There is no analyst of democracy or philosopher of democracy. You can't find one who doesn't put political equality at the core of their thinking. So that's the big problem. It also distorts campaigns because the candidates don't campaign across the country. Donald Trump, who campaigned much more broadly than most candidates, still didn't go to 31 states in the entire election. He didn't, and almost 99% of his advertising campaign advertising was in 14 swing states. And 57% of it was in four states. So it distorts the election. It's just like, and if you live in Florida. Excuse me, if you live in Texas like I do, if you live in California, you live in New York, you live in many other places, and that includes small states just go right up the center of the country. There's like no election. Nobody comes, nobody advertises, there's no yard signs, nothing. Nothing happens. It's just like it's not there. So that's the biggest disadvantage of the current system. I don't think that there are any advantages of the Electoral College, to tell you the truth, because every advantage that people propose as an advantage, when you look at what actually happens in the real world, it doesn't pan out. It actually generally turns out to be exactly the opposite. We've discussed a number of those this morning.
We only have about a minute left, but we have an email question. Has the Electoral College ever been challenged in court? Have the recent gerrymandering cases provided a possible roadmap for an Electoral College court challenge?
I don't think that it hasn't, that I know of. I mean, there's been questions about various aspects of the Electoral College, but not about the Electoral College itself. And it's a very thoughtful question that you have. But I don't think so, because the Electoral College is right directly in the Constitution, so it's very difficult to find something in the Constitution to be unconstitutional.
So do you see a day when the Electoral College will ever go away, or in 50 years when somebody else is hosting this program and somebody else is in your position, will they be having the same conversation?
Well, it's a long shot, but it is possible, particularly if we can educate people about the real consequences of the Electoral College.
Dr. George Edwards is University Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M, also teaches American Government at Oxford, the University of London, Peking University, among others, and the founder and former director of the Center for Presidential Studies. Thank you so much for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.